Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Now, on Monday, when the Supreme Court justices begin their new term, they will have yet another defining affirmative action case on the docket. They'll be considering the constitutionality of a Michigan ballot measure that would ban racial preference in education and other areas of state or local government. And the understanding of what affirmative action is for may have a defining role on the decision. Is it meant to promote diversity? Is it supposed to help protect against ongoing discrimination or make up for past injustices? Or is it meant to foster a more racially integrated America? Joining me now is Randall Kennedy, professor at the Harvard Law School. His new book is For Discrimination, Race, Affirmative Action, and the Law, in which he compares these four reasons for affirmative action. Dr. Kennedy, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks so much for having me.
I guess not Dr. Kennedy. Even though you're a professor at Harvard, if you're a lawyer, it's not doctor, right?
Mister is fine.
Okay. Esquire. This book is both a personal as well as academic defense of affirmative action. And you begin with a brief history of how the policy has helped you in your career. Can you tell a little bit of your own story?
Well, sure. I'm from the Deep South. I was born in 1954 in Columbia, South Carolina. My parents were refugees from the Jim Crow South. I've seen the really terrible side of the American race line. But I indicate as well in my book that I've also been benefited by affirmative action, the better side of the race line. I've been benefited by what I call the affirmative action ethos. Throughout my life, both as a student and in my professional career, I've benefited from people reaching out a helping hand to me and to other blacks of my vintage to help elevate, help advance the fortunes of African Americans and other people of color who've been historically marginalized in this society.
And which of the various purposes that you discuss in the book do you think affirmative action has played in your case? And let me mention them again for listeners: to promote diversity for its own sake, to help protect against ongoing discrimination, to make up for past injustices, or to foster a more racially integrated America.
One of the things I wanted to do in my book was to put all these justifications on the table because, frankly, as of late, We've focused almost entirely on the so-called diversity rationale for affirmative action, the idea that institutions, including colleges and universities, will be better if they bring to the table all sectors of American life. The idea being that we can learn from one another's experiences and different perspectives. I think that that's a good justification, but I wanted to bring to the fore these others that have been pushed to the side, particularly by the Supreme Court. In my case, I think, frankly, that I've been helped by people who've been moved by various justifications. I think the idea that I could maybe bring a different perspective was probably in the minds of some of the people who've hired me, you know, to be a professor. I think the idea of trying to make up for our racist past played a role in the teachers that I encountered in high school. So I think all four justifications are in play and have been in play for the past 30 to 40 years.
Listeners, you want to talk to Randall Kennedy? And whether you agree with affirmative action or not as policy, I wonder how you listening right now define its purpose. What does affirmative action do? How do you see it? Do you support it or oppose it based on any of those four rationales being more legitimate or more illegitimate as policy in America, in your opinion? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Maybe you work for an institution that practices affirmative action, be it a university or a company or whatever. How do you see it in your case? Is it meant to promote diversity for diversity's sake, help protect against ongoing discrimination, make up for past injustices, or is it meant to foster a more racially integrated America? What do you think? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. We had New Yorker staff writer, the author Malcolm Gladwell, on the show yesterday to talk about his new book, David and Goliath. And there's a section in the book where he frames the affirmative action debate this way, that the supporters who see it justified by a history of discrimination, the opponents who stress academic merit, and those who push for class, not race, are all missing something, he says. And that is, quote, what all these three groups take for granted is that being able to get into a great school is such an important advantage that the small number of spaces at the top are worth fighting over. But why on earth are people convinced that places at the top are so valuable that they're worth fighting over, unquote. And what he does is he cites statistics that more than half of all African-American students in law school are in the bottom 10% of their law school classes by the end. So being a great student at a good school, he argues, is the same or better as being a not-so-good student at a great school. Mm-hmm. So affirmative action may wind up getting African-American potential lawyers into better schools than they should be in for their own success. Have you heard this argument before?
Sure. It's been around for a long time. It's called the mismatch thesis. Is there a point to it? There is a point to it in that affirmative action, like any other policy, can be stupidly designed. So if you have an affirmative action policy that over-promotes people and puts people in places where they're going to fail, then that's not good. On the other hand, to address his question about elite institutions, it's worth noting that the Supreme Court of the United States has nine people on it. All nine have come from two law schools, Harvard Law School, where I teach, and Yale Law School, where I was a student. Now, that says something about the influence, the power, the halo that is given. And maybe, by the way, it's an illicit halo. I'm not saying that this is a good thing, but I am saying as a reality, there is a reason why parents all over America are doing all that they can to get their kids into certain elite places, because these elite places do have an outsized influence in determining where people end up.
Mitch in Hoboken, you're on WNYC with Randall Kennedy. Hi, Mitch.
Hi, how are you? Great show. Love it. Listen every day, actually.
Thank you.
I just want to say, I actually run a small production firm based out of Hoboken, New Jersey, make a lot of the hiring decisions, both for internal staffing and on our various productions. And when it comes to race, I personally do not use it as any sort of calculus or bias into my decisions whether to hire people. I believe it's really the quality of the person and their prior work experience that determines a lot of these factors. And I do believe that using race only is to the detriment of these people. Because if it's a known factor, then unfortunately a lot of people will look down at them and always have that supposition that maybe they were hired because of that.
Professor Kennedy, do you want to try to convince Mitch to change his hiring practices?
Well, two things. First, Mitch does have a point. One of the prices, one of the costs of affirmative action is its stigmatizing effect. That's right. It does put a cloud over people who are perceived to be beneficiaries of affirmative action. On the other hand, there's always the question, you know, compared to what? The fact of the matter is that we've had affirmative action for four decades at least, and overwhelmingly, certainly amongst black Americans, there is a deep-seated belief that it is worth the cost, and at least in my experience, it is worth the cost.
Mitch, anything else you want to say before I go?
I can definitely understand that opinion. I don't necessarily agree. I, again, really do believe it's, you know, the quality of the work of the person. And if they come in with a positive attitude and can prove to me that they're hardworking, I don't care what race, ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, or anything about the person. They'll come out, work hard for me. That's what I want to see.
I respect what you say. I would suggest, however, that when you said with great authority and definitiveness that you don't take, you know, race into account, we've all grown up in a society that is soaked with racial biases and preconceptions of all sort. Mm-hmm. I think it would be very difficult, frankly, for anyone in this society to be free of judgments, beliefs, intuitions, given the way the society is structured.
I definitely agree with you on that, and it definitely does color people's, predispositions going in. But, I definitely agree with what you're saying. I just try to be as neutral as possible with all hiring decisions.
Mitch, thanks so much for your call. Call us again. I really appreciate
it.
And I appreciate you listening as often as you do. Scott in Yonkers, you're on WNYC. Hi, Scott.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody. Two points I'd like to make. To me, the biggest problem with affirmative action is that it's always associated with black people. The 500 years of de facto, almost 100% affirmative.
Whoops, we lost you there for a second. Scott, wait a minute. I think we have you.
I'm
sorry, Scott. We lost you for a second. You said the problem is that the history of affirmative action is associated.
The problem is that affirmative action is always associated with black people, when really for 500 years, white people, and I'm a white person myself, have had pretty much de facto 100% affirmative action for this country's entire existence and well before. But it's never called affirmative action. It's not called affirmative action when every single white host, every host of Meet the Press, for example, has been white. But I'd like to make a further point. I attended Bennington College, and I went to my 25th reunion this past weekend. And we've always had, it's a great kind of, you know, liberal arts college and great politics, but we've always had a tremendous diversity problem there. And we had a panel about this, and we were discussing what to do. And we found out, among other things, only one out of 107 professors there is black, and that professor is very well qualified, but he's from Nigeria. For an educational institution in America to not have one single African-American professor, to me, is crazy.
Scott, I'm going to leave it there, and you put a lot on the table. And Professor Kennedy, anything? It wasn't a question exactly, but he's certainly stating a problem.
He certainly is, and I think his first point in particular is an excellent point about the way in which preferences in our society has many sorts of preferences. The one that seems to kick up the most antagonism is associated with preferences for African Americans. People don't talk in the same way about gender preferences. They don't talk in the same way about preferences for in-state students as opposed to out-of-state students. They don't talk about the same way about preferences for veterans. We have all sorts of mechanisms in which we try to assist people in various sectors of our society. And so I think that the caller made a very excellent point.
And thank you, Scott, for calling in. So colleges and universities now are turning more to race-neutral admission policies that kind of use class as a surrogate for race to some degree. The University of Texas, for example, which accepts the top 10% of any high school class in the state, but since there's so much segregation in high schools, that's 10% of mostly black schools, 10% of mostly white schools, et cetera. So it tends to promote and result in some diversity without mentioning race in the policy. And, of course, Texas was at the heart of that Fisher case from last year's Supreme Court term. But I gather you don't like that workaround.
Well, I mean, I like it compared to nothing. But to call that race neutral is not really being candid. I mean, the Texas authorities passed that law in the aftermath of a court case in which the court said you cannot take race into account. Well, because you couldn't take race into account, the numbers of Latinos and black students was going to go down precipitously. And so the legislature, and mind you, this is the Texas legislature. This is no, you know, wild liberal legislature. This is a conservative legislature. The Texas legislature said, you know, we can't have a system like this, publicly supported system, that has so few Latinos and so few blacks. So they created what people now call a race-neutral system. But, of course, it was race-conscious. And so, once again, we're sort of hiding the ball when it comes to race by not calling things, you know, by their real name. The fact of the matter is this rate that the Texas top 10% plan is race conscious. I'm for it, you know, in comparison with alternatives, but I would like for us to reach a point where we could talk about our problems more straightforwardly.
Tommy in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Randall Kennedy. Hi, Tommy.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Yeah, I was just kind of going to agree with what Professor Kennedy was just saying. I think that it's you know, a part of his background is the same background that my mother and people from her generation had, is that, you know, they have very real disadvantages because of the basis of their race, especially in higher education. And these are disadvantages that result in, you know, their inability to provide the same educational opportunities to their children, who are often, you know, also African-American, or at least partially African-American, Latino, et cetera. So I think that, you know, it's good to say diversity is good, but we still have, you know, very much an issue to resolve when our parents, you know, parents of the people who are 23, 24 years old, very much didn't have the same access, you know, less than or just over 50 years ago.
So to address past discrimination and ongoing discrimination. Tommy, thank you very much. But to relate that back to the class-based question, your children, Professor Kennedy, I have no idea of your family status, but your children might not face the same hurdles of the children for college admission, let's say, as the children of people like he's talking about.
True.
Who have been poor as parents, maybe more uneducated raising their own kids.
True. Couple things. Number one, I'm strongly in favor of affirmative action, but we ought to recognize the class tilt of affirmative action, particularly with respect to higher education. The people who are beneficiaries of affirmative action in higher education tend to be people in the middle on upward ranks of racial minority communities. The poor black people are not helped directly anyway by affirmative action with respect to higher education. They're simply not in a position to take advantage of affirmative
action.
And
I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that's one of the biggest problems going forward, is that those who've already gotten a leg up then get more legs up through the system as it exists.
That's true, but they still need help. And for the people who are below, the truly poor, or what William Julius Wilson calls the truly disadvantaged, we need to supplement racial affirmative action
with
all sorts of things to attack class inequality in American life. There are lots of poor white people. I'm all for interventions to assist poor white people. But while we do that, let's not knock out racial affirmative action.
We're just about out of time, and our board is full of great callers who we're not going to be able to get to. But you can all go to WNYC.org and keep the conversation going with each other there. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. But I just want to get your take on the Michigan case that the Supreme Court will consider in this new term that starts on Monday. What's at stake?
Well, the people of Michigan erased affirmative action. And the question is, can the people of Michigan erase affirmative action?
In a referendum? Is that how they did it?
That's right. They did it by voter initiative. And that's happened in a number of states. It's happened in California. It's happened in Michigan. It's happened in other places. I feel quite certain that the Supreme Court of the United States is going to reverse the United States Court of Appeals, which invalidated the voter initiative.
That means you're asking the Roberts Court, or they're asking the Roberts Court, to affirm a fundamental requirement for some kind of affirmative action in the Constitution?
No. It's a really complicated case, because I think that the people who are attacking the referendum, what they're saying is, you can engage in regular politics, but by making this part of a state constitution, you are doing something special. You're entrenching this and really putting it out of the power of a minority to change things. So I think it's a complicated case, but I feel pretty certain as to what the outcome is going to be. The outcome, the Supreme Court, in my view, is almost certainly going to reverse the lower court and say that the people of Michigan can, if they want, outlaw affirmative action and entrench it in their constitution.
Harvard Law Professor Randall Kennedy, his new book is For Discrimination, Race, Affirmative Action, and the Law. And he will be speaking tonight at 6:30 at a ticketed event at the New York Historical Society. If you want to see Professor Kennedy in person, there is a link with more information on our website at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, is the Village Halloween Parade at risk of not coming back after being washed away last year by Sandy? It would be 4 weeks from today. We'll talk to the organizers. Stay with us.